Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Let me start with the 2018 Open Championship. This event, this tournament was complete and utter chaos. Jordan Spieth said on Saturday night, expect the unexpected. And this guy's never been more right. With the wind whipping up, Carnoustie went all carnasty, both in terms of how it played and in the way that it jacked with guys' heads. So chaotic that Spieth's disastrous sixth hole, which included a hard target search of the brambles, a cut finger, and a double bogey, and was actually the most predictable thing of the day. That's how it was for Spieth at the Open last year. A wild hole, and then he turns it around. Except that did not happen yesterday. I'm telling you, yesterday was complete chaos. And then the cat made a run. The cat took over the lead. There was a six-way tie for first. If you wanted one scorecard to sum the entire thing up yesterday, check out Rory McIlroy. Two birdies, three bogeys, and an eagle. And that was all in the first 14 holes. I mean, it was so weird that Eddie Pepperell, a guy that nobody had even heard of before yesterday, went out and shot 67, completely hung over, had himself right there in contention. Think about that for a minute. Tiger, Rory, Jordan, one single name guy after another, making a run and falling apart, crumbling under the pressure of dealing with that track. But not old Eddie. Eddie had been hitting the sauce the night before and then was getting super saucy on the course. Hey-o! Meanwhile, a dude from Northern Italy who lives in London, Francesco Molinari, was quietly playing a near-perfect round. Went out in 36, came back in when it mattered most, with the Claret Jug was on the line at 2-under. So while everybody else was melting down, Molinari was just rolling it in. Oh, and he was doing it on a course that even he admitted he wanted nothing to do with in the past because it had been that tough on him. I mean, yeah, that was not the playbook, or that was not the storybook ending that everybody was rooting for. And it's got nothing to do with Molinari. It's just that he's not Tiger Woods. Pretty hard to ignore the Tiger in the living room here. No one's denying that the champ is a worthy champion. Two wins, two runners-up in the last five starts. You might not know who he is, but his peers do. Check out Justin Thomas. He tweeted, quote, "What a round by @FMolinari. Played with him Thursday through Friday. Not surprised. Guy is the hottest player on the planet currently. Bogey-free out there today is a championship round." End of tweet. And that's the key. While everybody else was making one mistake after another, Molinari was just error-free. But don't think for a second that that's easy. That all you have to do is go out there and not make a mistake and the jug is yours. Playing bogey-free golf at your local Muni is tough enough. Doing it at Carnoustie on a windy championship Sunday is ridiculous. That just does not happen. That was a stone-cold round. This guy showed no pulse whatsoever. Even if he did admit that he went to the practice greens right when he was done, not to prepare for more golf in the event of a tie, but to avoid watching it on TV. Because my man didn't want to get sick. For most of the day, Molinari wasn't even the guy. And then even after he won, I'm still not sure he's the guy. To be honest with you, I'm not even sure that's where I wanted to start this morning. However, the guy? When the guy doubled 11, bogeyed 12, Molinari just kept on working. He did what nobody did back in the day. This guy did what nobody could do back in the day. Paired with Tiger Woods on a Sunday in a major, he outplayed him. He outclassed him. He got over. You get with Tiger on a Sunday in his prime, it was guaranteed to add four shots to your round. You were staring at 76 even before you teed it up. Not this guy. He blocked out the pressure. He shot 2-under. So while everybody was losing their bleep, getting nostalgic, and preparing to celebrate like it was 08, Molinari crashes the party big time. And he didn't do it by ripping the title in dramatic fashion. I mean, it was the opposite of dramatic, but it was totally professional, and you can't help but hype the guy. Respect the guy for that. Playing on a course that you don't like, playing with a legend, with everybody completely losing their minds and Twitter breaking into a million pieces, and then you don't blink, you don't flinch. You're the champ, even if your friends and family are the only ones in the entire world who were rooting for it. Man's game, F. May not have looked spectacular, but it was unbelievable. What a tremendous round. In the worst conditions, on the biggest stage, when the entire world was pulling for the guy that you were playing with. Couldn't be more impressed. Alan Shipnook is my guest. Alan, it is great to have you back on. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Listen, so let me start here. It was one of those tournaments where the winner was not necessarily the focus of the story, but why don't we start with Francesco Molinari. On a day where chaos was happening all around him, what do you make of the way he handled himself on a championship Sunday at a course that you know he doesn't necessarily love?
Well, it was a big-time performance. I mean, this guy's been a known quantity in the golf world for a while. He's played on Ryder Cups. He's won a lot in Europe. And, you know, he just won Tiger's event in Washington, D.C. Last month in a blowout. So you could kind of see this coming. But to play the entire weekend out of bogey on such a quirky, potentially nasty golf course was just incredible display of, you know, ball control, course management, scrambling. Just it was an awesome performance, and he's a great champion and fully deserving. But as you said, he was probably the number three storyline on Sunday. I mean, the first one was Tiger's run, and I think even overshadowing what Molinari did was Spieth's collapse. So it's one of those events where you got to give the winner his due, but there was kind of more interesting things going on in some ways.
You know, I agree with you. He might have been the third storyline, but I also agree when you say he's a great champion. I mean, he really is a great champion. I know the two of you had a brief exchange right after he won. What was your sense as to where he was at emotionally in that moment?
Yeah, well, that was even before he had won. He was waiting for Xander Schauffele to finish up. Schauffele was playing 18, and Molinari was just trying to kill time, and it looked like it was going to happen. I mean, Schauffele had to pull out from the fairway for an eagle, which is one in a million shot in that circumstance. But he was pretty jumpy. He was pretty tight. I mean, it was cute, and he was just walking past me, and our eyes locked. And I know Molinari a little bit. I mean, from being on the Euro Tour, I just said, "How you doing, man?" He's like, "How do you think?" I don't have a good Italian accent, but it was funny. You know, he was feeling it. You know, that's the biggest moment of his life by far as a golfer, and strange things do happen, especially on the last hole at Carnoustie. So he was just girding himself for some weirdness. But as it turned out, he won pretty comfortably.
Alan Shipnook, senior writer for Golf Magazine, a columnist at golf.com, and the author of 6 books. You've also got a great piece up right now on golf.com, and you talk about the story of the day, Tiger Woods. Now, what did you think as you watched him on the first 6 holes?
Yeah, I mean, I was out there and inside the ropes, and it was just a clinic. I mean, he didn't miss a shot. He was striping the ball, and the Open is the most freewheeling and fun of all the major championships. Even though it's those stuffy old gents from the Royal and Ancient who conduct the tournament, they kind of let things go out on the golf course, and people are running around like crazy, and there's not a lot of crowd control. There's a million people inside the ropes. I mean, it was pretty much anarchy out there. And yet Tiger just exuded such a serenity and peacefulness. I was just struck by even when he was making birdies on the front nine, there was no fist pumps. When things weren't going his way, he was flatlined. And it was interesting because we know how fiery he could be. And he just seemed so serene and so calm. And it was really striking given the circumstances. And as he's marching up the board, everyone was losing their mind. And I wish he could have held on to that for, about 12 more holes, because as soon as he summited the leaderboard, that vibe kind of disappeared. There was this grimace that took hold on his face, and he was muttering to himself, and even the pace he was walking at was quicker. And Tiger got a little rattled, let's face it. He got a little out of rhythm, and he made some really uncharacteristic mistakes out there that cost him the tournament. And how do you think about Tiger's performance is kind of reflective of your worldview, right? Are you an optimist or a pessimist? I mean, by any rational measure, when you look at this guy's been to hell and back in the last decade, this time last year, we don't know if he's ever going to play golf again. You have to say he's 42 years old with a lot of scar tissue, physically and emotionally. to even give himself a chance is an unbelievable achievement and a towering performance. And you have to tip your cap to him. On the other hand, Herbert was there for the taking. I mean, he had the solo lead. The course was playing short. He's hitting irons off the tee. He's battling, you know, against Molinari and Schauffele and these guys who've never won a major. The entire crowd, the entire continent is on his side, and he just let it get away. So, you know, it was discouraging. Big picture, maybe he'll build from here, and this will continue his ascent. But I mean, at this age, at this point in his career, how many golden opportunities is he going to get? And it was tough to see him frittered away the way he did.
The Monday edition of the Daily Jungle is brought to you by Fan Exchange. Bust on over to fanexchange.com for a safe, easy, and reliable experience. A great experience. Tickets purchased on Fan Exchange are always guaranteed. There's no getting to the gate and then worrying about getting in. Fan Exchange gets you closer to the action. Find the very best seats at the best prices at fanexchange.com. Use the promo code ROME. Again, promo code ROME and get 50% off the service fees on your next purchase. Fan Exchange, we have tickets. You know, Alan Shipnuck, my guest, that was such a great answer. There is so much to unpack in that answer, but let me ask you this. I mean, seeing him in the lead on Sunday at a major, does that make you feel like then, I mean, you're right, depending on your point of view, does it make you feel like it's only a matter of time before he wins one? Or does the way he responded to being in the lead on Sunday, not very well, does that make you wonder if he is ever going to get another one?
No, you really have to question if he's going to get it done, because there's other things that went into this whole performance. You know, with the fairways at Carnoustie, it was a racetrack, right? The ball was running forever. So Tiger didn't really have to hit many drivers. And that's the weakest club in his bag now. And so that was very advantageous. I mean, future Open Championships might play the same way, but you know, the course setup was so good for him, where he could just hit irons off the tee. And yet, when he went double bogey bogey, it was with iron in his hand, and he put two in a row in the rough. Just unbelievable mistakes on what should have been a pretty basic shot for him. And then the other thing that the other hole in Tiger's game right now is making putts. And when he had that 8-footer for double to save bogey on the 11th hole, I mean, that was the defining moment of his tournament. It all came down to that one putt, because you cannot recover from a double bogey in a shootout like that. There's just too many good players on the board. And for Tiger to miss that putt, I mean, he just has not putted the way he used to, especially under pressure. And, you know, the nerve endings are a little frayed. I mean, he's been through the war so many times. Nobody putts better in their 40s than they do in their 20s. And the putts just aren't falling for Tiger. And even the wedge shot that set up that double bogey, you know, that was an unbelievable mental mistake. He's left of the green. The pin is tucked behind a bunker. He's got acres of putting surface beyond the flag. You just knock it over to the flag, the 20 feet. Either you make the putt or you don't, but you contain the damage. But he tried to stuff a little flop shot out of the rough next to the flag, and that brought double bogey into play. And, you know, Tiger might be the greatest tactician in golf history, and that was such a stunning just brain fart. And so you look at the driver, you look at the putter, and you look at the thinking under pressure. There's some major red flags going forward.
Yeah, I mean, you just laid this out really nicely, Alan. But the fact of the matter is, if his swing starts to betray him the way it did as soon as he takes the lead, I mean, I'll just pose the question one last time. Is it a coincidence in terms of timing, or is it something else altogether?
I mean, it can't be a coincidence. He was hitting it so beautifully through most of the front nine, and then the tournament just went haywire. You know, Spieth making double bogey, Schauffele making double bogey, and Tiger, who had just kind of been lurking and plodding along, all of a sudden he's at the top of the board, and that's the exact moment he starts spraying the ball and missing putts and making mistakes. I mean, it can't be a coincidence. So, and you know, he was really in control of the ball first three rounds too. I mean, he was striping it nicely. And you know, you can say, well, he hasn't had a chance to win a major in 5 years, and that's true, and it's a learned skill. And on the other hand, he's already had a couple golden opportunities to win this season. So even though the comeback is only, you know, we're only 6 months into it, he's been in this position. He's had a chance to feel those nerves and that adrenaline and see how his body reacts to it. So we're kind of out of excuses at this point. I mean, he had a chance to win the Open, and he didn't get it done. It's just that simple.
Alan Shipnook, it is that simple. Listen, before you go, I've got to ask you. You've got a fascinating piece right now. You did it earlier this month about spending a day with Phil Mickelson. I have to know, what was that experience like?
Well, it was great fun. I mean, Phil's a good company. The guy, he talks a lot of trash. He's got opinions on everything. Periodically, he would grab my phone when I was recording the interview, and he'd press pause, and he'd tell me something really juicy or profane, which, of course, I couldn't use. And then he'd press record, and we'd be back on script. But, we hung out at his club in Rancho Santa Fe, the Bridges, went to his house where he's got this unbelievable backyard practice facility. And we tooled around. He's got this souped-up golf cart that's 50 miles an hour. It has direct TV, and we're – Rancho Santa Fe is somewhat rural, right? We're on these roads. And every time we come into a corner, it's like, you got to lean into the turn, man, because the tires are chirping. It looked like the cart was going to flip. I mean, I was kind of bummed because I figured if we died, I was not going to get mentioned until the third or fourth paragraph. But luckily that did happen. But, Phil's very polarized. People love him or hate him. But a little airport noise there. But he's definitely good company, and I enjoyed my time with him.
Hey, Alan, does he look and move like a black belt in Taekwondo?
I know that was a little nugget from that our time together. I mean, I've actually seen Phil in the gym, and he's kind of like a pigeon, right? Round, and but yet they're graceful when they get going, and they can move, and it's unexpected. And that's kind of how Phil is. I mean, he is an athlete. He does have some tools. You wouldn't know it looking at him, but. He's also an obsessive. I mean, I think it came out a little bit in that story. I mean, when he gets into something, he dives really deep. So he kind of devoted his life to getting that black belt. And then he's like, yeah, okay, I'm done. And he doesn't even really practice anymore. But for a period of time, it was a very important thing in his life. And tells you a little bit about his determination and maybe his obsessiveness.
It seems really unusual to me. Let me ask you this before you go. What about his relationship with Tiger Woods? Where do you think that is right now? And for instance, how much has that changed over the years, and why?
Yeah, they grew up 100 miles apart, separated by, 5.5 years. And, Phil's older. And he kind of lorded over Tiger's early golf life. Tiger grew up trying to chase Phil's records. And if you know anything about Earl and Tito Woods, I mean, they kind of instilled in Tiger this dislike for a guy that they really didn't know. And so it was always pretty frosty. And, of course, Tiger came out on tour and immediately usurped Mickelson as the best American player. And, they had very little chemistry for most of their career. But that certainly changed, as Tiger has become a family guy like Phil, in a weird way, Tiger has needed Phil more than vice versa, post-scandal, because Tiger wants to be loved and accepted and treated as this elder statesman, and that's who Phil is in the golf community, and Tiger's never been that. And so it was kind of this cold war that didn't suit Tiger's purposes, and, Phil was kind of the big personality on the Ryder Cup and the President's Cup team, and Tiger had to make peace with him so he could be accepted in those settings, and they kind of combined forces to reshape the U.S. Ryder Cup effort, and that was bonding for them. And when Tiger was going through his chip yip period, Phil offered to help him. And now one of the things that I broke in the reporting of that story was this $10 million match that they're gonna team up on, and that's not a one off. I mean, they look at this as a franchise where they're gonna play a few every year. They're gonna go around the world. And they're setting up the ownership structure where they're actually going to own this whole entity. So we'll get the TV money and the merchandising and the sponsorship. And so this is a long-term relationship that is born out of friendship, and now it's turning into a business arrangement. And, I mean, let's face it, it never made sense to them not to be friends. But who can relate to the scrutiny and the controversies and life in the public eye? In the modern media age, only these two guys can really relate to what the other one experiences. And so it's overdue, and it was prickly for a while, but they become buddies. And, it certainly is a good thing for the golf world to have them on the same page and enjoying each other's company and doing these kind of ventures together.
So one last thought, Alan, you've been on the beat a long, long time. You can speak to this. I mean, Tiger, his swing is different. His body is different now as compared to 10 or 15 years ago. How different is he as a person now versus Tiger then? Has he in fact changed?
Yeah. You know, I, I kind of sneaked into this players only area after the round yesterday and you know, caught some very tender moments between Tiger and his kid. You know, that's in my golf.com story. And, you know, I've never seen Tiger look so disappointed after tournament because he wanted to win it for his kid. You know, he talked about it very movingly during the week that he wants them to know who he was. You know, his daughter's 11, his son is 9. Basically, their entire life has been post-scandal, back surgeries, where he's been this diminished figure in every way. And, you know, Tiger used to play for his dad. And when Earl Woods died, he kind of lost his way. And now he finally has another purpose in his golf. And that he wants to win so badly for his kid. And that's a profound thing. And certainly he's changed as a person. You know, he's just not the same guy he used to be. Can he be prickly and aloof? For sure. But there's a lot more humanity. There's a lot more need for connection. I mean, he isolated himself from the entire golf community by choice. You know, he liked being a lone wolf. He liked doing things his own way. And after his life blew up, he looked around. He had no friends. He had nobody that he could relate to professionally or personally. And I think he was profoundly lonely. And he's worked really hard to build relationships with other players, with caddies, select media members. The entire tour community. You know, Tiger needed golf more than golf needed him in the last few years, and that was a profound shift for him. And so he's a different person for sure. But by the same token, he's a different golfer. I mean, part of what made Tiger great was that entitlement. You know, he felt like he deserved to win every tournament because he'd been up since 5:30 a.m. And the same thing that got him in trouble off the course. You know, he wanted it all. He wanted the money, the fame, the women, all of it. And so now as he's become a better, kinder, gentler person, I don't think he has the same killer instinct on the golf course. He's just not the player he was because he's not the person he was. So it's part of what makes this comeback so fascinating is all the different layers. Tiger's trying to reinvent himself, his golf swing. He's trying to figure out who he is as a competitor. He's trying to win for his kids. I mean, there's just a lot going on. You know, before he was kind of like this robot, and now he's much more human and flawed, and it's compelling. And you saw some of the frailties back nine yesterday at Carnoustie.
Look, if you're sharing a bed with somebody who snores, don't wait on them to fix it because they probably won't. Fix it for them. Get them a Zipa. Make sure they put that gift to good use. You'll both be better for it. Zipa is spelled Z-Y-P-P-A-H. Z-Y-P-P-A-H. It's actually Happy Z spelled backwards. Now, if you go to bed with a Zipa, you wake up with Happy Z's. Did you know that one night of bad sleep can ruin your entire day? Are you planning a summer vacation? You do not want to ruin the entire vacation with snoring all night long. Vacations are supposed to be a time for rest and recovery and relaxation. Well, how do you expect to get any rest if there's somebody snoring all night? What if that somebody is you? If you're snoring, you're not sleeping, and neither is anybody else. This is why you need to get a Zipa before you leave on vacation. If you or somebody you know snores, just go to Zipa.com. Zipa is guaranteed to stop snoring. You've got nothing to lose. If you're not happy for any reason at all, just return it, get a full refund. Snoring is rude, it's disrespectful, and it's offensive because there is a solution. Do not ruin another summer vacation with snoring. Get your Zipa today by going to Zipa.com. Zipa.com. Ensure you and everybody around you has a great summer vacation. So again, you had Francesco Molinari, who was the man yesterday, but for much of the day, he was not. For much of the day, the man was a 42-year-old whose last major was 10 years and countless surgeries, scandals, trips to rehab ago. The cat. And yesterday, it was all about one word, back. And for the first time in a long time, it was not about his back. It was about whether or not he was back. Because for the first time in a long time, for the first time since wrecking his back, he actually looked like he was back, legitimately back, like he might legitimately rip a major. And I don't even mean that as a setup to where I play a clip of him complaining about a fan yelling, although we did get that too.
Well, Molinari gives one back.
No! What are you doing?
We're yelling, Tiger swing, he's looking over to the left.
Yeah, that was right in the middle of it.
I mean, speaking of backs, Tiger, went into yesterday on the back of a third round 66, which gave him a very good look. And that look got even better when he birdied 4 and 6. And the roars were getting louder. The moment was getting bigger. I mean, it was legitimately exciting. There's golf excitement, but then there's Tiger Woods golf excitement. And with all due respect to every other player who tees it up and wins, Tiger Woods' excitement, even now, is still different. It's bigger. Tiger Woods' excitement is just, I don't know, it's more exciting. So let me save you the worn out, golf is better when Tiger is contending take. Because of course, golf is better when Tiger is contending. That's like saying water is wet when, well, it's water. Everybody knows now golf is better when Tiger is better, because that's when everybody knows there's golf. And yesterday, most people knew that golf was being played, even if it was being played across the ocean. Now, don't get it twisted. Like his game, Tiger's impact now is not what it was in his prime. It's not even close. Back then, golf fans, non-golf fans, non-sports fans knew when Tiger was contending for something that matters, that transcendent. Never mind you didn't give a damn about golf and you knew. You didn't give a damn about sports and you knew. If you had ears and eyes, you knew. Back then, he set the entire world on fire. Now it's just the sports world. But that doesn't mean there's not a buzz, because there was a ton of buzz. And for 23 minutes, when he had the lead, on the Sunday of the Open Championship, the internet was on fire. Back in the day, the fail whale would have been doing laps on Twitter. Fortunately, Twitter servers are a little more robust these days. So instead, it was just one Tiger emoji after another from Tiger honks who were buzzing hard on what they were seeing. Tiger was back. The guy who made golf exciting was back. The guy who made golf a must-watch was back. The guy who made golf cool was back. And of course, that's a double-edged sword, because what that also means is, while he made it cool for tools and wannabe frat bros who love to shout things like mashed potatoes or drop lingo like stripe to show just how cool they really are. Yeah, whatever. For 23 minutes, when he was in the lead, it didn't matter. Nothing mattered. For 23 minutes, Tiger was once again the biggest thing in the world. For 23 minutes, Tiger honks were mainlining that drug. Oh, and speaking of the honks, let me take a moment to address you. I'm not here for you to come in today and say you always knew this was going to happen. You didn't know this was going to happen. You hoped it might happen. You dreamed that it might happen. You prayed that it might happen. But don't tell me you knew this was going to happen. And by the way, it still hasn't happened. He made a great run on the weekend, something he has not done in a long time. However, and Alan Shipnuck, I thought, did a great job of laying this out. He crumbled when it mattered, something he has done recently. It was an awesome charge. I'm not here to hate at all. It was an awesome charge. It was a great moment. And for a bit, he was playing some great golf when it mattered most, when other great players around him were falling apart. Except the second he got that lead, in the end, his game simply did not hold up to the pressure of the moment. It just didn't. And yet again, it's a reminder, this is a different Tiger. The old Tiger would have dropped out of the lead of a major on Sunday, or would never have done that. The old Tiger would never have done that. The older Tiger does do that. And as he would say, it happens. It happens to us all. In fact, no sooner than he took that lead, that's when things started to go a little haywire. Par saves on 8 and 9, but then the double on 11 and the bogey on 12. You don't win the major on the back nine by going double, then bogey. That said, great performance from him at a major for the first time in a long time. Just be sure you pump the brakes a little. Anyone guaranteeing another major is begging. Yes, he led on a Sunday at the Open, but he didn't make it to Saturday and Sunday at the U.S. Open, and that was last month. This much we know. he could win another major. We didn't know that before. We thought he might be able to. Now we know he could, but he hasn't. And he could have and probably should have. And until he does, that's all this is. A could. An exciting could, but a could. He's not back. That old Tiger, he's never coming back. That old Tiger is dead. But this one is competitive. And looks like a different dude off the course. And by different, I mean like a pretty good dude. So I'm going to reserve further judgment about that and his game. But that was a good weekend for him. Good weekend for him. Good weekend for the sport. But pump your brakes on. You knew it. And it guarantees another major. Because it doesn't.
Yeah, it happens.
Stamps.com is literally one of the best time-saving services I have ever used. Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. And my favorite thing about Stamps.com is it saves you time and money, which you can put back into your business. You can grow your business that way. I can mail any letter, any package by using just my computer and printer, and then the mailman will come and pick it up. I love it. So what you need to do is create your own Stamps.com account. You can do so in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. Click, print, mail, and you are done. I have used Stamps.com for a long time because it is so fast, it is so easy, it is so convenient, and it does save me money. Right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer, which includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. All you have to do is go to stamps.com, hit the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in jungle. Once again, I love this service. I know you will too. Go to stamps.com and enter jungle. Yogi Ferrell is my guest. Yogi, it's really nice to have you on. Good morning. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Let me first ask you, you agreed to that deal with Sacramento. What was it about the opportunity in Sacramento that appealed to you the most?
I think the main thing is that I like their youth and I like the way they play. Their style of play is faster. They get up and down. And I feel like that's the same game I've played my entire life. So I feel like I can go in there and kind of mold the identity of the Kings and just give them another spark that they need.
You know, and I know they see you the exact same way. They've said as much. You know, your basketball journey to me is amazing. If we go back a little bit, you were undrafted out of Indiana. You played in the D League. Then you got an opportunity with the Dallas Mavericks. You made the most of that. You had a 10-day contract in January of 2017. And then you were the Western Conference Rookie of the Month in February of that year. You played all 82 games this past season. So what's life been like for you since January of 2017?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. Time has gone by fast, that's for sure. But, you know, I'm taking every moment of it. I'm very blessed to be able to have even been in the position to allow myself to excel in this league. But like you said, I was undrafted and, you know, played a couple games with Brooklyn, didn't work out. And, you know, I just wanted to make sure I was ready for my next opportunity. I knew it was going to come just because of how hard I work. So I just wanted to be ready when I got that 10-day call up for the Mavs. And I just wanted to show and prove everybody wrong and make sure to tell everybody that I belong in this league.
Always better to stay ready than have to get ready, and we know that. Yogi Ferrell joining us. Now, listen, initially it looked like you were going to stay with the Mavericks. They extended a qualifying offer to you, but then rescinded it, and then it appeared like there might be an agreement on a 2-year deal, but then you ultimately signed with Sacramento. What was that whole decision-making process like, and were there any hard feelings on either side?
There were no hard feelings on either side. Mark Cuban, he was the one that gave me my first opportunity in the league, I feel like. And Coach Carlisle is a great coach. When he first put me in, I'll never forget the first practice, he told me I was going to start. And the next day we were playing the Spurs. So everything was kind of coming pretty quickly. But, you know, I'm very fortunate that they were able to put me in the position that they were in. And there were no hard feelings. And, you know, I decided that I needed to change in my career and – you know, kind of like my style of play, I feel like it fits better with the Kings and the Mavericks.
You know, Yogi, I wonder, because when you look at the fact that you're in this position to agree to a 2-year deal, it's a testament to the work that you've done, the work that you mentioned. You go back to when you first came into the league, you've been grinding. When you go undrafted in 2016, it might have been easy to get down, maybe even go into the tank, but you didn't do that. What was your mindset and your attitude at that time?
My attitude at that time was the same. That night, I remember I wasn't drafted, and the very next day I was in the gym. You know, the only thing I've known is to get in the gym and work. You know, I always say work is undefeated, and I feel like God definitely blesses those who work harder than others. So, you know, one thing for me was that, you know, I just had to stay true to myself and bet on myself and just believe in my ability. And I've had a great support system with my families and, you know, different people that I've worked out with. And I just feel like it's just a testament to it.
You know, one of the things you just said, in fact, you said on this, I've heard you say this off air, and I've heard you say it to me just now. You want to come in there and you want to help mold that team's identity. I mean, it's a veteran comment, but you're still just 25. Where does that approach to being a leader and molding a team's identity come from?
Well, I feel like the way I can kind of mold the identity is, you know, make everybody a little bit more grittier. You know, I feel like in practice, I'm going as hard as practice as it is in the game, just so the game is a lot easier. So in practice, I'm just going to go at dudes' heads, play tough defense, attack them on the offensive end, and just make sure that we have that fire under us every time we step on the court. And, we know, when we're all playing with that same fire on the court and we're together, you know, that's going to give us a better chance of being successful.
You know what? I wish you and I had more time together, but I want to ask you about this. Last month, you took more than 100 kids in foster care to see Uncle Drew. It's part of an ongoing commitment that you've had to children in foster care, and it's motivated in part because of your mother's experience growing up in foster care. What has she told you about her experiences?
You know, she's told me she kind of had a rough childhood growing up, her and her siblings. I'm just going in and out of houses, and I was able to see that my mother still has that same motivation and that fire to this day to do what she does. And she just doesn't let past experiences determine, you know, what happens for her future. And she's had a lot of great people come in and help her out. So, you know, I feel like I want to do the same. And I was inspired by my mom and the successful woman that she's became. So I'm just trying to empower these kids, give them the same support system that, you know, she got and even she gave to me during my career. I just want to give these kids the same support system so they can be as successful as possible.
And she is a doctor, Lydia. Your mother is a doctor right now, and she continues to give back. You know, Yogi, you and I have not spoken before, but I used to talk to Tom Crean about you. You had a camp recently, and a number of IU guys showed up to help, even guys that you didn't play with. What's that tell you about the IU basketball family?
Man, that just shows that no matter what generation, when you play for Indiana, they're going to be there for you. And I thought that was really cool. And I'm thankful for that they were to come down because the energy was kind of dying down. And the kids were asking me, you know, where are the IU players? So when they showed up, it was great. The energy picked back up. They were playing knockout, playing two-on-two with them, interacting with the kids. So, you know, that was really great that they were able to come down just for a couple hours and interact with the kids.
He agreed to a deal with the Sacramento Kings. He was an NBA All-Rookie second-teamer in 2017. Yogi Ferrell, my guest. Yogi, listen, really good to have you on the show. Hopefully, once you get settled and the year gets underway, we can do it again. I'd love to have you back on.
Of course. Yeah. I'll come back out to L.A.
I'll take you here in L.A. We'd love to have you in studio. That'd be awesome, Yogi. Listen, man, have a great day. Appreciate you.
All right, thank you. You too.
Love that. Definitely come to L.A. Just like that. Just like that. Smackoff 24 is in the books. Now, unlike last year, when I did dip for the basement after Smackoff 23, this year I'm back on the Monday after so we can talk about it and break the whole thing down. Me going on vacation right after that, honestly, is not the best way to go. It's kind of hard for me to set up those vacations and match up everybody's schedule and make it all work. So sometimes we get stuck and I get jammed that way. Not this year. This year I'm here to talk about it. So many moments that I want to revisit and I want to reset. So if you heard the show on Friday, and you want to react to what you heard on Friday, and you don't need my reaction, you have your own reaction, do it. Hit me up. What was your favorite call? Did I get it right? Who showed up huge? Who disappointed the most? I want to see all those tweets and emails because I do owe you a post-game show. And since I didn't do it then, I'm going to do it in part right now. Hit me up. Let's talk about what went down on Friday. I mean, if that thing doesn't jump the weekend, what would? Let's take a look back. Let's take a look and a start with some of the analytics. Friday Smackoff set the bar for most calls taken during the event since 2001. Remember, I started the show by saying, you better call now. Get in. You're going to get shut out. Not all of you who deserve a shot to be on the air are going to get on the air. I was actually wrong about that. 19 in total got through. An average of, what, 2.5 calls per segment? So if you were looking for volume, you got volume. If you were looking to hear some fools get wrecked by the manual buzzer, then you got that too. Because of those 19 calls, 32%, and this is hard to imagine, right? Because this day is supposed to be for the best of the best. But then again, the bar is higher on this day. 32% of those who got through got absolutely hammered by LT.
Rick in Buffalo, we have to absorb that profile picture that looks like a horseshoe crab wearing glasses.
And granted, your skill set isn't that great.
Started working on my call at 9 a.m. Pacific. That's what I've prepared.
Left, Doug. Nothing. Not a damn thing. The same thing he's been doing the past 2 years, Bubba. Hell, Bubba, I'm flaming, but I'm out, man. I got to go. I love you.
Remember the time when you, Alvin, and me were at a Carl's in Rosemead, and we saw Najee Davenport rounding third and go into a laundromat with a boner and sweatpants?
He needs to put down his mom's copy of 50 Shades of Grey and pull his pants up and do something productive in the world, like chew a box of razor blades so he would swallow his own for a change.
Mona, you gotta be kidding me, Mona.
You don't like that cup.
I don't like that cup. Not a very good cup.
So Jay Stu, for instance, knew exactly what he was doing. He wanted that buzzsaw. Mona from Knoxville must have thought that she was on satellite radio or a podcast or Jim Rome on Showtime, because that was one of the dirtier, more inappropriate takes and lines that you've ever heard on this show. Makes you wonder what else she had after that blast. Bodie just did what Bodie does. No surprise that Bodie flamed out and self-ejected. I mean, that's what Bodie does. He's still the best. Danica, I'm not going to lie. I was stoked to get your call, but very disappointed that you could not find a good connection for the big stage. That's on you, not on me. John in New York. My man, that was one of the worst smack-off calls ever. And I didn't even let you get halfway through. But you're a good dude. You're a good dude, but I'm going to keep it real. That was more hack-off than smack-off. How do you hear the 14 calls that come before you and then stay on the line to try to deliver something that whack? But I've still got your back. John, you can call anytime. Anytime, just not on that day. Unless you commit and go back to work. And Chad in L.A., dude, your stock has never been lower. I was the one who had your back. I was the one who said you were a sleeper and a great value bet. And then you show up with the worst cell service of the day and said you started working on your call at 9 a.m. before cutting out and getting run. You started working on your smack-off call at 9 a.m. the day of the smack-off. I mean, the amount of respect that you showed the smack-off on Friday is the amount of respect that I have for you right now. None. Come on, man. You got to be better than that. Especially when I have your back and I'm hyping you up. Now that that's out of the way, why don't we get to the calls that did finish? Checking in early, hitting the board with his first career top tenner, Matt in Van. He got off a few good shots on Lef, Brad, and Chad.
American clones have been calling me Pretty Boy because I go to the dentist twice a year, and I pay more than $9 for my haircut. Jesus Christ, Lef, did you catch the irony in the fact that you, Lef, completely jumped the shark using a video featuring the guy who originally jumped the shark? And holy crap, Mike and Indy's retirement bit, while slightly less corny, was equally embarrassing. Everyone saw it coming. No one was impressed. But at least neither of them have adopted Brad's strategy of just being a pitchy bitch with D-minus smack. This cool just talks like a game show host on bath salts, and it still doesn't hide the fact that he has worse smack than everyone in the smack-off field not named Chad in L.A. And speaking of that ho-ass non-factor, Chad's parents are actually holding a reveal party this weekend, even though Chad is 32 years old.
Dude, a gender reveal party for a 32-year-old person? Are you kidding me with that? And that take about Brad Smack didn't hold up very well either. It's all right, Matt. It's all right. You did all right. You did all right. You did all right. You had some moments. Now, I did want and expect more from you and Tyler both, but there is no denying that you guys were the gas cans for months leading up to the Smack Off, and you helped drive a grip of hype heading into the event. In ninth place, the 2010 champ, Vic in NoCal.
Little Alvy's an animal. Dude, that guy gets more ass than Kelly Clarkson's Lazy Boy. Little Alvy multiplies like a Catholic rabbit. Maybe he can help out Caleb in Green Bay, man, because the only women in Caleb's life are Betty Crocker, Little Debbie, and Wendy. I mean, look, I'm not saying Caleb isn't skilled with the ladies, but if he were a Star Wars character, his name would be Han Solo. I mean, my man Caleb has such little game, and he's so fat, that he doesn't invite chicks over to his pad to Netflix and chill. He invites them over to Netflix and grill.
So Vic had his moments, obviously. He had moments on Friday, but for the third year in a row, Broadway delivered the week of, but not the day of. Dude is still a content machine with great game, but he's got to figure out how to ramp up, not down, on the big stage. Maybe the best eighth place finish in the history of the event goes to Caleb in Green Bay, who made his call from a time machine way back in 1995.
I would never miss the first annual Great American Smack Off. I knew that 1995 was going to be all that and a bag of chips, so I'm going to hit this competition harder than Natron means business up the middle on first and goal. Let's get after it, Jim. You know why I take a lot of scuds? Because I get a lot of scuds. And you know this better than anyone. There is a long, long line of callers waiting to take a swing at me like I'm a pinata full of welfare checks, spouting the same unoriginal takes, fat, virgin, lives with his parents. But it just goes to remind everyone that your listeners are not clones of you. They're clones of each other, clogging up the phone lines, jamming up the fax machine day after day for years on end. Would it shock anybody when you open up the fish wrap and see they finally caught the Unabomber? He won't be living in some shack in Montana. He'll be like a mechanic in Escondido wearing an extra Sports 690 t-shirt and asking the feds for a drug test drop. Crown, Wisconsin. Huge.
All right, so that call right there was clever as hell. And you need to hear the whole thing to really appreciate his angle. All the references were an homage to the first Great American Smack Off back in 95. Very smart, very well executed. But there were still seven better. Seven better. That's how good a day that was. Which brings me to the rookie, Rick, in Buffalo. Rick went off for 5 minutes and crushed everybody in his crosshairs, starting with Jeff in Richmond. And Vic from NoCal.
And greetings, Jeff in Richmond. I'm Pedro Martinez. You're Don Zimmer. And you better get your decrepit fat ass back in the dugout. And welcome back to Twitter, Vic in NoCal. Didn't take you long for you to start bitching about losing all 5,000 of your followers after the Twitter purge. But what the hell did you expect after following back 5,000 robot whores last month, you scumbag?
I mean, listen, it's one thing to take a run at some of the top dogs in the field. One thing to take a run at pretty much the entire field. But quite another, and I've not seen this before, quite another to take down your own old man in the field. Something Rick also did.
My first love as a kid was Yankees baseball. And while I still root for the team, I absolutely despise their deplorable fan base. And there's no bigger a-hole Yankee fan out there than my old man. He's the type of insufferable D-bag who brags about having seen every inning of every game since 1960. Sure you have, you fat ass. Funny how you leave out the fact you sleep through the last three innings every night. And your snoring's really starting to piss off Mom. And I'm sick of her calling me to bitch about it.
This guy just annihilated his dad. Took apart his old man. And why don't you just jam a Zipa in there? That would fix it. Plus, if that weren't jarring enough, his war at the end was an all-timer.
War, road rage with the kids in the back seat. It's never too early to teach them not to take crap from anyone.
That was Rick in Buffalo. Hawk, really quick. Put on the phones. Just do it. Don't ask why. Just do it. Adam Hawk, EP. All right, so I missed the Woodscopes on Friday, and apparently was Rick a topic, or did Rick call in? Was there another anecdote coming off of Rick's call?
Yeah, Rick put himself with a landline in a part of his house where he didn't have any facilities to relieve himself. So he also brought in, quote, a piss bucket. Can I say that? A pee bucket?
You can, yeah.
A bucket for urinating into the room that he was making his call from because he didn't know when he was going to get on.
Dude, that's good. That's good. Why not just go adult diaper with it?
To me, it's a very respectful move to the show.
Right.
He's putting the show before his own relief.
A diaper would have been even more respectful. All right, that's good. That's smart. All right, thank you. That's smart. He didn't know when he was going to get on, so he brought a bucket with him. Coming in. Nice job, Rick. Well done. Coming in at 6th on Friday, Mark in Hollywood, the 2013 champ, who, like everybody else, went right in on Team Canada.
Speaking of Matt and Van and Tyler and the I really think you two believers are confused about what being fit means. It doesn't count when you're rail thin due to your booger sugar diet and your exercise regimen of sticking your fingers down each other's throats. So you have a stable country with a smart, level-headed, non-racist leader who isn't cucked by Vladimir Putin on the daily. Boring! Now please, get your asses back up north, and y'all better sponsor my Canadian citizenship when Trump deports black people. And for the rest of y'all, man, I don't care if you're the B-I-C, the B-I-C, if you're a D-I-C, like M-I-K-E, I got a Ph.D. in Smackology, the title is coming back by way of Philly, so forget the 5G's, Rome, I did this for free, and there's only one thing left to say, Cronny!
It's a great effort by Mark. Nice, nice effort, but on a day like Friday, not even good enough to get into the top five. Let alone a crowning. That tells you how good Friday was. It's John Morosi. John, good morning. What's up? How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim, and certainly still basking in the afterglow of my countryman Francesco Molinari's Vittoria Ieri, the big win there yesterday, the first ever for an Italian golfer in a major, so very excited about that.
That was so great, John. Really quickly on that, how much did he show you in the way of composure? I mean, you're looking at a guy like that when everything, there's so much chaos around him. It's all about Tiger Woods. It's a track that even Molinari himself said he's never been very comfortable with. How much composure and class did he show you in those moments?
Was very impressed. I think he both during the round, certainly, and even afterward, I thought he handled the victory speech, which I always give credit to anybody that does those speeches in their second language and handle it with the class that he did. I thought was outstanding. But yeah, I agree. Just the composure, and it was a crowded, obviously top leaderboard there. There was a number of players that had a chance to win that thing right till the very end. And I think he with the way that he separated himself, a bogey free championship for him. So remarkable performance by Molinari, and again a cause to celebrate, Jim, for the Italians who missed their team in the World Cup this year, as Mike Tirico so eloquently said at the end of the broadcast last night. I think it was a very, very fitting conclusion to the summer sports season there in Europe for the Italians.
Easy, John. The Golf Channel might call you next. You'll have to add another line to the resume. John Morosi joining me. All right, John, let me ask you. Manny Machado, he's got 5 hits in his first 3 games with the Dodgers. How does he look to you so far in Dodger gear?
Jimmy looks great in that number 8 jersey for the Dodgers, a perfect fit. And I think you look at the journey of this franchise, it was 10 years ago, of course, another Manny from the American League East comes over, Manny Ramirez, and they're able to make it all the way to the NLCS that year. But a series of unfulfilling October since then, of course, getting within 9 innings of the World Series title last year. And Machado, to me, Jimmy, feels like he is the separator for this team. They didn't need him desperately. Maybe some other teams actually had a greater need for Machado than what the Dodgers did, but they made the deal. They were maybe bolder than they were at last year's deadline. Remember, Justin Verlander was out there for them. They passed. They got Yu Darvish instead. And you wonder if maybe this year getting that star that was out there that everybody wanted, a very powerful message to their clubhouse, and we're already seeing the impact. And I thought very interesting comments this morning by Dave Roberts in the LA Times about how the positioning of Machado defensively may already be better than what it was previously. In other words, the metrics defensively were not kind to Manny, but maybe with some better positioning in L.A. than what he had with the Orioles, perhaps that performance will improve. So I think shortstop has been very promising so far. The at-bats have been great. Looks great in the uniform, so a great star. I cannot wait to see what the reception is going to be for his first home game at Dodger Stadium 1 week from today.
John Morosi joining us, and it does speak to the mentality, right, of that team. They go out and they get Yu Darvish last year. They make the move for Manny Machado this year. So where, in fact, John, does that leave them among the National League contenders after adding Machado?
Great question, Jim. I would say they are co-favorites to win the league along with the Cubs. And I know it's great. We look at rivalries in our sport, and we may have a third straight year of a Cubs-Dodgers NLCS, which I think would be great theater. I think the Cubs in some ways are better, at least that their lineup is better. Javier Baez becoming a bona fide superstar, although the Cubs have some rotation concerns that they may well address in the next week. Of course, the trade deadline is 1 week from tomorrow. So the Cubs may still look at that, and maybe even Zach Britton for the bullpen. But the Dodgers, to me, with Machado, and they may still want to address the bullpen. I think they probably still find a way to get one or two more pieces for the bullpen. But their overall position player group is outstanding. They've welcomed back now Alex Wood, Rich Hill, some returns to health for their starting rotation. Ross Stripling is there. Clayton Kershaw is back now, taking a regular turn. So just with their internal improvements with the rotation, I like the Dodgers' chances. To me, Jim, so I think it's a clear co-favorite scenario, Cubs and Dodgers, while you see teams like the Brewers have regressed. They are now only just one game safe of a wild card spot. 10 days ago, they had the best record in the National League. They've had a disastrous stretch here in the last week and a half or so for the Brewers. They've got to find a way to reverse this downward slide for them, because the Cubs right now taking a commanding lead, and I'm excited to see what happens there in the National League East with those upstarts, the Phillies and the Braves.
And not only that, John, it's got to be so tough for Milwaukee to see Machado in a Dodger uniform when they try to get him himself, and they see what
Great
he's doing
point.
For L.A. Now, you mentioned bullpen help. How about Cleveland? Cleveland goes out, and they get two-time All-Star reliever Brad Hand. What do you make of that move for Cleveland and that fit?
Great fit, near term, great fit, long term. They gave up Francisco Mejia, who was one of their top prospects, maybe their best position player prospect, but he has not really shown, actually when I talked to Mejia a couple weekends ago, he made the point that he still wants to work on his in-game adjustments with pitchers and pitching coaches to maybe take that next step as a defensive catcher at the major league level. And so as long as he was struggling in that area and not fully embracing a position switch, he wasn't really going to help the Indians in the lineup every day right now. So they called him up right before the break, a little bit of a showcase, had some good at-bats, and the Padres liked him enough to make him the main piece, in fact, the only piece, coming back for Brad Hand and Adam Simber. So I think it was a very reasonable acquisition cost for the Indians to pay, given Mejia's near-term fit was unclear, and it really allows them to solidify their bullpen for this year. Of course, they hope Andrew Miller is a factor here now, coming back off the All-Star break, and also Cody Allen maybe getting a little more regular rest. But this also allows them to effectively let Allen and Miller go as free agents after the season is over, because both Hand and Adam Simber are under control for next year. So just a masterful job, I believe, at the deadline. Very reasonable cost and a perfect fit for the Indians roster, both in 2018 and beyond.
John Morosi joining us once again. All right, John, speaking of a showcase, Chris Archer struck out 13 in six innings yesterday against Miami, and there were some very interested observers at that game. Who were they, and what do you think they made of what they saw?
Well, Jim, it's a great point, because it's not just how well Archer pitched, it's who was watching him do it. And by Bill Chastain of MLB.com, his accounting, there were 12 different scouts in attendance. Now, that was the grapefruit state series, if you will, between the Marlins and the Rays. So there were certainly some scouts there looking at the Marlins bullpen pieces who were very much in demand. But there was certainly a strong audience there for Archer specifically. And one point that Bill made in his piece, which I think is very salient, is that the Rays have been seen recently scouting the Yankees' rookie league affiliates. Jim, there are no coincidences when it comes to scouting assignments in the month of July. That tells me there's a lot of smoke right there between the Yankees and the Rays on Archer. Now, big picture, Noah Syndergaard on the DL with the hand, foot, and mouth disease. We have seen Michael Fulmer go on the DL as well. So while we're seeing some possibilities that the Yankees have been linked to, now off the board, Archer has now made three starts since coming back from the DL. He pitched very well yesterday, was showing some power stuff. All of a sudden now he is on the rise, and I think it's why it's so important, Jim, to watch these trade deadlines unfold day by day, because sometimes a name that you weren't talking about 2 or 3 weeks ago all of a sudden becomes a major name right now, and there's a very good chance as we sit here today that by a week from today or a week from tomorrow when the deadline happens, Chris Archer is in a different uniform. It may well be that of the New York Yankees, who need a starting pitcher above all else right now at the 2018 trade deadline.
John, I was going to say, I mean, the Yankees are five games out of first in the East. Knowing how much every team wants to avoid that wild card game, can the Yankees afford to not make a move?
Well, I agree with you, Jim. They can't, because let's think about this. You talk about the wild card and pointing out how that map to October could go for them. Well, let's say they have to play that wild card game against the Mariners or the Athletics, and they've got to expend a Luis Severino in that game. CC Sabathia certainly is very deserving of a start early in that series, but after that, Sonny Gray has been up and down. There is some youth there with Domingo Germán. You want to have another solid veteran and or ideally a former All-Star type pitcher to pitch one of those first couple of games of the division series if you have to go out and win the wild card game with Severino on the mound to begin the postseason. So I think it's not just about getting to the playoffs for the Yankees. You have to find a way to have your rotation strong enough to win the World Series, and that involves being able to win that first-round series after having to win the wild card game against, oh, by the way, you're probably facing the Boston Red Sox in the first round if you win the wild card game, because they're probably going to have the best record in your league. So there are so many layers of the story, but you are absolutely right, Jim, that with the Yankees having to possibly play that wild card game, you've got to build up enough starting depth to just get through the first round of the playoffs, having to expend your ace before that division series even begins.
John Morosi joins me for another moment or so. Since you mentioned Noah Syndergaard, let me ask you about that. His name has come up in trade talks, but as you point out, he's going to the DL with hand, foot, and mouth disease. First of all, John, I got to ask, what was your reaction when you heard that? And then does that pretty much end the Syndergaard trade talks?
Yeah, Jim, it's a very troubling and worrisome circumstance. The hand, foot, and mouth disease can be a very serious illness and has some side effects to it as well, especially, I guess, for those that are very young or very old, so hopefully Noah does not fall into that category. But it's certainly a concerning situation for the Mets. He's going to go on the DL, obviously, for at least 10 days. I think it eliminates much of the circumstance of him possibly being traded. He was already trending in that direction where he's missed so much time this season to begin with. And also remember, the Mets have come under criticism for the relatively light return in the Juris Familia deal. Their handling of Yoenis Cespedes has come under scrutiny as well. It doesn't feel like to me that, especially with Sandy Alderson on a leave of absence to deal with cancer and have treatment for his health, that it just does not seem to me that this is the right moment for them to make decisions of this magnitude, trading a Syndergaard, trading a Jacob deGrom either. So certainly Familia, they made the deal over the weekend, but our very best wishes are with Noah Syndergaard as he battles through this illness, and hopefully he's only missing this week and a half here and he's back on the mound in August.
Show. You're already a legend on the show, John, and like all the greats, you're not going to let an injury stop you, but I want everybody to know that you are playing hurt today. This is essentially your Jordan flu game. Can you go behind the curtain for a moment? How did you hurt your hand? How are you dealing with the pain?
Well, Jim, I appreciate your concern. Yeah, it was somewhat evident this morning on the MLB Network, so no sense in hiding it. I would love to tell you, last week at the All-Star break, I was away with my family up north. I would love to tell you that I was fishing and hunting and being a true woodsman, and I injured it in that capacity. But in all actuality, I was looking for my razor blade when I got back home in the bottom of my duffel bag, and I found it when it sliced open my finger. So that was probably not my I do not have a graduate degree in common sense, it would appear, Jim. That was not my finest moment, my friend. So
yeah.
Playing hurt day to day with a right middle finger laceration. I'll try to I'll try to, you know, I'll be on the air all for an hour tonight on FS1 Whip Around Show, so I got to try to find a way to not be so evident about it for a full hour of TV, but we'll do my best. I'm playing her, and certainly, Jim, it's not as though I talk with my hands anyway, and or that I need my hands to write a lot this week at the trade deadline.
Of course not.
For goodness sake, so I'll do my best, Jim, to soldier forward here.
That's it. Of course not. Way to man up. It's Macho John. It's happened to every last one of us. I see you working. I understand. I appreciate you very much. So good to have you back on the show, John. Heal up, and I know we'll do it again soon.
My pleasure, Jim. And again, it was great seeing you there when I was out there last month. It was a pleasure to see you in person.
Yeah, that was so fun, John. I appreciate you making time for that, too.
My pleasure. Have a great week, Jim.
You too.
Talk to you again soon. You bet. Thank you.
All right, so let's continue with our recap of SmackOff 24. It's been a good show today. I started this way back in hour one. So as we finish off looking back at it, five calls, the top five calls that dented the leaderboard. Coming in fifth for the second straight year, Benny in Wisco.
Hey, Jeff Passan, thanks for participating today. Your call was the Brandy Chastain plaque of SmackOff calls, all distorted, poorly crafted, and in dire need of being melted down and reconstructed. Vic, you're the Ian Poulter of the SmackOff every year, buddy. You're always in the lead after Thursday, but once the weekend hits, your score takes a sailor dive into a pile of rocks. Hey, did everyone catch Leffen Laguna's RSVP videos? Man, oh man, there are plenty of cringeworthy items to take away from them, but none more prominent than that plastic scepter and plastic crown you were sporting. A helium balloon in studio a couple years ago, a plastic scepter and crown this year. What are you, the king of Party City?
Benny, two SmackOffs, two top fives. Think about that for a minute. It's an incredible effort. Two SmackOffs, two top fives. The guy's got staying power. And you have to think, maybe, I don't want to say this for certain, but maybe it's not a question of if, but a matter of when. Maybe. Stay at it, Ben. You're better. You're way better and more diverse than just Rat Smack. Speaking of a guy who has won one, Mike in Indy, fresh out of retirement and cracking skulls like he always does. Yes, the call finished fourth. No, I can't imagine he's very happy about that. But it doesn't mean it hurt any less for the Cablanasian, Keith Arnold, or Leffen Laguna.
Cablanasian was gone but not forgotten. Nobody forgot how bad he sucks. Thanks for proving once and for all that the top dogs from your era are only worth sixth place in the Mike and Indy era. Today I'm going to play a little game of show and tell. I'm going to show you all how great I am, and then I'm going to tell you about it. I got the pure vicious smack that the SmackOff was built on. Multiple terrorist organizations try to take credit for my call last year. My call last year was so dope, Adam Hawk tried to buy some of it. I know everybody's saying I'm responsible for the Leffen Laguna rule, banning studio appearances, and that's true. I got that done. But it was to protect Rome against a psychopath like Rick and Buffalo. Rome doesn't exactly have a crew of ass-kickers on the other side of that glass. You got Hawk who threw out his back putting on his shoes. Alvey would just hit the dude, no, no soundbite, while Keith Arnold takes a hands-off approach, just like he does every day at work. This guy works like he's got a guaranteed contract. I haven't seen him do a damn thing since he showed up. Are you kidding me, Lef? Nice pre-recorded, doctored-up call. Take out the gimmicks and that call sucks so bad it might have sucked another Southwest passenger out of airplane window.
Mike, I gotta tell you something. I mean, that's such a good call. If that's a fourth place call, it again speaks to how damn strong the top three were on Friday. Yeah, that's classy, Alvin. That's good. That's good. Somebody got sucked out of a window. Somebody got sucked out of the side of a plane. Yeah, that's classy, Alvin. You're now free to move about. The atmosphere didn't want any of that. None of us have any say in how we go. That's the worst way ever to go. And you've got that soundbite. That's classy, son. Anyway, if I can get back to the program, Alvin, Mike's call was tremendous. But it was a fourth place call. Make no mistake. That was the fourth best call. That was one of the best calls ever, but that was still a fourth place call. The fourth best call because of the top three. So the biggest question coming into Friday was the double champ going to be able to get it done and go three-peat without his patented studio storm? Turns out the answer was running good old-fashioned straight-up smack was one of the tools in his tool chest. It was a bat in his bag.
Congrats on getting the show on Sirius XM. I mean, how cool is it that Sam Cassell and Willie McGee can now listen to me on extraterrestrial radio? And, Jimmy, how great is it that SmackOff falls in the only week without any pro sports? I mean, who scheduled this thing, Brad and Crona? I mean, dude has less interest in opening the sports section than Shaq Griffin has in opening a pickle jar. I mean, look, I'm not saying that Brad has no sports knowledge, but when you're trying to buy Dodgers tickets on the 50-yard line, it's probably time to put down that Us Weekly.
So Lef had some great lines all over the call. But this is Lef we're talking about, right? I mean, he had great one-liners, but it is Lef we're talking about. So there were cameos from Henry Winkler, Mike Franzese, and a former NBA coach that maybe some of you have heard of.
Hey, Romy, that didn't go so bad, huh? No studio, no gimmicks. Oh, hang on. I got another call coming in. Hello?
Hi, it's Larry Brown. Congratulations, Jim, on all the success, and I love the show. But you have to stop prank calling me. I don't want the gym membership.
There you have it, Jimmy. Hang my towel on the rack.
Larry Brown. Legitimately Larry Brown.
Larry Brown.
Telling me I need to stop, quote, crank calling him. That was an amazing moment. That was a holy bleep moment. I mean, I don't remember the last time we had Larry on the show. But Lef found him. And says he found my idol, Ron Say, and Cato Kalin, and our horse, Straight Fire. I mean, Lef was working overtime, maybe to compensate for the lack of a studio rush. It's a great call. I mean, he did what he does and did it really well. Those smack-offs, the smack-off, always has those holy crap moments. And that was a holy crap moment, him finding Larry Brown and Larry Brown telling me to stop crank calling him.
Larry Brown.
So, if you're not going to get it done, if you have to vacate the throne, you better at least hit the podium. You better at least hit the stage. And he did. Lef did. Nobody can deny this dude's three-year run because it's been amazing. And I'm really anxious to see what he comes back with next year. Which brings us then to the top two. If that fourth place call might have been good enough to win any other year, if the third place call definitely could win any other year, what about the top two? One of the toughest judging decisions we have ever had to make around here. Because the call that ended up taking the silver started out like this.
I had one rival back in the day. That was the Calvin Asian. I loved kicking that guy in the nuts during my phone calls about his balding or his weight gain or his radio career. I mean, Jesus, that guy was so fun.
No, thank you, Steve. ABC's attorneys are online, too. I got this. Jim, it's great to be back.
All right, so what you heard right there, what that was right there, if for some reason you missed it right there, that was the 1998 champ, Stevie Carbone, having his call interrupted by his one-time rival, five-time champ, Sean the Cablanasian, a guy that we have not heard from in these parts since that three-peat way back in 07. So you want to talk about a holy bleep moment. The most decorated smack-off caller returning after an 11-year absence is that moment.
Since when did you need a SAG card to construct a smack-off call? Back when I was winning this thing, all I did was roll out of bed, pop a few Adderall, and jot some bullet points down on a piece of paper. Now apparently you have to arrange the family reunion to win this thing. Damn, Lef, there's easier ways to win $5,000 or make $5,000. Donate a kidney, hold up a convenience store, insurance fraud, something. And Brad and Corona, hey, man, I'm looking at this list, and I see you've won three of these, I guess, which means two more smack-off wins, and maybe you, too, can be the Kendrick Perkins to Jim's LeBron James on the CBS Sports Radio Network, 6 to 10 Eastern Time, Sundays, clones. Tune in. Hey, Jim, just use my address in the CBS Sports Radio directory. You can send me my retroactive $25K there. Do the math, clones, five times. Love you, Jimmy. Out.
He did, man. He's got five. He's got five, and he hasn't called in 11 years. The Cablin Asian, tremendous comeback. So is that a one-off, or is he back? Is he in the hunt? Is he trying to take the money? Only time will tell. Only time will tell, but time will forever remember the Friday when Stevie Carbone resurrected his dude who made his first appearance in over a decade. That call wins in any other year. For a moment, I thought that call might win this year, but then the champ called. When we come back, a reset of the winning call. The champion of Smackoff 24, obviously, Brad in Corona, the BIC, a guy who now has four titles to his name. And if Team Canada was getting the whole jungle bent out of shape in the months and weeks leading up to the event, nobody was more suited to body bag those two dudes than the BIC. Brad wasted no time and no articles of clothing in doing just that.
I got really fed up with Matt and Tyler talking about how good-looking they are and calling all Americans fat because we're not all fat. So I got a custom-made banana hammock with Matt's face right up by my banana and Tyler's face around back near my hammock. Breathe it in, boys. Hey, I love the pictures Matt and Tyler sent in today, by the way. I just want to say for the record that you guys aren't even good-looking. Tyler, apparently the rhinoplasty procedure hasn't made its way north of the Canadian border yet, because if it had, you would have already whittled down that massive schnoz of yours into something more manageable. Dude, your face looks like that helmet Brad Pitt wore in the movie Troy. I also enjoyed those pics of your girlfriend from earlier in the week sitting on that motorcycle. Yeah, judging by the way you and your boy Matt like to make your sandwiches, I'm guessing that's probably the only hog she'll be riding anytime soon. By the way, bro, bring that chick down to Southern California. She's a 7.5 at best down here.
Rest in peace, bros. Rest in peace, bros. But that was not Brad's only target. They were not Brad's only target Friday. He also went in on Mark in Hollywood.
Mark in Hollywood made the transition this year from actor to professional author. And by that I mean he just writes home to mom and dad once a week asking for help with the rent money. I'm told it's an ongoing monthly series and quite tear-jerking for Mark's parents. I'm not saying times are hard for Mark in Hollywood, Jim. What I am saying is the only acting work he's had lately consists of trying to convince the cashier at Walmart that the dog food he buys once a week is actually for a dog and not for him to chow down on in the parking lot like they've caught him doing on the regular.
I'm telling you, nobody does it like this guy. He even figured out how to turn Cruz Pedregon's unbelievable offer of putting the winner's name on the side of his car into smack.
Hey, shout out to Cruz Pedregon for volunteering to put the Smackoff winner's name on his race car for one race. Cruz, I don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth here, but dude, this ain't the Indy 500, man. You race NHRA drag cars that last for like 5 seconds. The only thing quicker than that with less publicity would be if Vic in NoCal volunteers to shout out the winner's name the next time he has sex.
Brad. Brady Corona! Good night now!